Hello and welcome back to our digital class on Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. This is its last and ninth lesson unit entitled Light Scattering on Polymers. In the preceding lesson unit, we have got an introduction to the fundamentals of scattering methods. We've seen that with these methods, based upon the interaction of quantum objects and matter, rich structural insight into amorphous polymer samples can be gained on multiple length scales quantified by the scattering wave vector, which generally depends on the wavelength of the scattered radiation or quantum objects and the scattering detection angle. By suitable choice of the wavelength, as realized by the utilization of either X-ray, neutron or light scattering, we can cover diverse ranges on that Q range, thereby coming to diverse insights into various hierarchical structural domains in a polymer sample. The most widespread technique in actual laboratories, however, is light scattering, as this methodology is instrumentally most easily realizable and also most cheaply realizable. This doesn't mean it's cheap, but cheaper than the other two methods. As such, we want to devote an own lesson unit to that very technique, which is the present, the last lesson unit of our class. With this, we will also close our circle of reaching out to unraveling structure property relations in polymer systems. Up to this point, we know a lot about properties already, specifically mechanical properties, and with the following lesson unit on light scattering, we will see how exactly structures in amorphous polymer systems are instrumentally most easily probed. When we consider light scattering, we are in the realm of low values of the scattering wave vector Q, thereby covering the zero angle or Guinier regime. In that regime, as we have seen in our last lesson unit, we obtain information about the molar mass and the size of the polymer coils. We do not gain information on their local chain structures, such as on their chain persistence or even local chemical specificities. We can generally distinguish between two sub-realizations of light scattering, which are static and dynamic light scattering. In the following, we will devote an own subchapter to either of those. We start with considering static light scattering. In very general, as we've said already in our last lesson unit, light scattering generates its contrast from the relative difference of the refractive indices of the sample and its environment. How does this physically work? If we consider an incident polarized light beam that hits a polarizable object, a so-called scattering center, it induces a dipole moment in that center, according to equation 6.23. The magnitude of this dipole moment is proportional to the magnitude of the incoming electric field, and the constant of proportionality is named polarizability. Due to that induced dipole moment, the scatterer itself starts to vibrate and emits radiation into all directions. It acts as an origin of a scattered spherical wave. The scattered electrical field can be quantified according to equation 6.24, and based upon that, we can quantify the intensity of the scattered light simply by calculating it to be the square of the electric field amplitude, as written in equation 6.25. In that equation, we see that the intensity has a distinct dependence on the frequency of the incident and therefore also of the scattered light. It scales with the frequency of the light by a power of 4. This strong dependence of the scattering intensity on the light frequency and therefore inversely to light wavelength explains to us why the sky is blue on sunny days, which is pretty often the case here in the Mainz area. Blue light has a shorter wavelength than other light colors, or expressed differently, it has a higher frequency. And so the blue portion of the white sunlight is scattered stronger than the other colors, thereby being the part of the light that hits our eye best, which makes the sky appear blue. Footnote, this also makes the seas appear blue, as those reflect the blue color of the sky. And further footnote, this also makes the sun appear yellow, because that shows the remainder of the spectrum, the white light minus the blue fraction, which is scattered away strongest. Footnote to the footnote, this is valid only at the height of the day, however, because at dawn and dusk, the path that the light is traveling through the Earth's atmosphere is longer as the sun is positioned lower on the horizon. And so the blue component is already scattered away completely, such that we see the remainder, which is the red-orange parts of the white light at dawn and dusk. Whereas equation 6.25 was a vague proportionality expression, the exact quantification is given to you in equation 6.26. This equation quantifies to us the intensity of scattered light scattered by a single scattering center, a single particle. To expand this to multi-particle systems, we have to sub-distinguish in what state the matter that scatters the light is, which microscopically means in what fashion its particles, its building blocks, are arranged mutually towards each other. The easiest system to treat is a dilute ideal gas, composed of n spherical particles with no interactions and great distances against each other. In this case, we only have to multiply equation 6.26 by the number of particles n, because each particle scatters individually with no interparticle interactions, giving us equation 6.27. The exact opposite of that state would be an ideal crystal, where the particles are placed close by each other on regular lattice positions. Such a state cannot be investigated by light scattering, because the distance of the lattice planes, which is in the picometer range, is much smaller than the employed wavelength of the visible light, which is in the range of some hundreds of nanometers. So each scattered beam at one of these lattice planes always finds a counterpart that causes exactly destructive interference. And eventually this leads to total extinction of the scattered light. Therefore, an ideal crystal doesn't scatter light. It appears transparent to us. It can at most be colored if it contains dyes that are the source of color, but nevertheless, it's not turbid colored, it's clearly transparently colored then. The intermediate of these two opposites is a liquid. Here, similar to the solid, the average distance of the molecules to one another is still much smaller than the light's wavelength, so light should still be extinguished. But in contrast to an ideal crystal, there is thermal density fluctuations that occur due to the thermal motion of the molecules. And due to that, not all of the scattered rays are extinguished. To treat that state, we first have to make ourselves clear that the polarizability of a molecule is usually anisotropic. If the molecule rotates and vibrates, this manifests itself such as if the polarizability would oscillate itself, as expressed in equation 6.28. If we insert that into the former equation 6.23, we generate equation 6.29, which tells us that the oscillating dipole moment of the scattering centers is fed by three contributions. One contribution is named Rayleigh contribution. It is an elastic scattering contribution, in the sense that the frequency of the scattered light is identical to the one of the incident light. In addition to that, there is two contributions where the scattered light exhibits a frequency shift compared to the incident light, either in negative or in positive sense. These two contributions are classified as inelastic scattering contributions, also named Raman scattering. There is two subkinds of those, the one where the frequency of the scattered light is lower than the one of the incident light, which is caused by energy absorption of the scattering center from the incident beam and emission of a scattered photon with less energy, which we name Stokes-Raman scattering. The other case is the one where there is energy transfer to the scattered photon so that its energy is higher than the one of the incident photon. This case is referred to as anti-Stokes-Raman scattering. For us, in the field of polymer science, the very first scattering contribution, the Rayleigh scattering, is the most relevant one. So we limit our further discussion to only this type. We first considered the simple case of a dilute polymer solution, which exhibits a refractive index of the solution as given by equation 6.30, which additively constitutes out of the refractive index of the solvent plus the change that it exhibits by the concentration C of the solute in it. In the following, we need to work with the polarizability, and that has to do with the square of the refractive index. So on the right-hand side of equation 6.30, we take the square of the refractive index, denoting as the quadratic formula that is given there. Due to the negligible influence of the term that occurs with dn by dc times c square, we ignore that increment in the following. Yeah, as just said, the refractive indexes are connected to the polarizability via a square relation that is precisely given in equation 6.31. When we apply this to the refractive index of the solution as given in equation 6.30, we generate equation 6.32, which has a companion equation, 6.33, that expresses the same formalism for the solvent only. By subtracting the very latter equation from the one before and taking the identity of equation 6.30 into account, we can derive a formula that connects the refractive index differences to the incremental refractive index change with concentration, dn by dc, as given in equation 6.34, which we can rearrange to the delta alpha term that describes the polarizability difference between the solute and the solvent, as given in equation 6.35. We can now insert the Rayleigh scattering formula 6.27, thereby obtaining equation 6.36. This equation establishes a relation between the relative intensity of the scattered light to an elementary polymer material parameter, m, the molar mass of the chains. There is a bunch of other parameters in that equation also, but except for the concentration C and the molar mass m, all of them are constant for a given experimental setup, so we can subsummarize them to a working constant. In that context, we also normalize the left-hand side of equation 6.36 in the sense that we take the relative scattering intensity and multiply it with R square and divide it by V to take into account the elementary dependence of the light scattering intensity to the sample detector distance, R squared, and the trivial dependence that the larger the scattering volume is, the larger will be the scattering intensity. So we normalize to that. We refer to this normalized quantity as the Rayleigh ratio, R sub theta, as given in equation 6.37a. And by summarizing all the optical constants together to just one experimental setup constant K, we obtain a very simplified form as given in equation 6.37b. This equation holds for a monodisperse sample, where the chain length is the same for all chains. If this is not the case, if we have a polydisperse sample, a variant form as denoted in equation 6.38 holds. From this, along with the definition of the weight average of the molar mass, as given in equation 6.39, we identify that it contains a weight average molar mass, and can therefore be denoted also as given in equation 6.40. From this very equation, a direct calculation of the weight average molar mass is possible from the Rayleigh ratio, that is a normalized light scattering intensity, which we measure in a static light scattering experiment, in a sample at a given concentration C, with a setup with an optical constant K. We can also derive this equation from an alternative viewpoint, which we get from the fluctuation theory, that is a combination of thermodynamics with scattering theory. We have mentioned already briefly earlier that thermal fluctuations of the density in our sample are the actual cause of scattering in solution states. To quantify those fluctuations, we regard our system to be composed of many elementary unit cells with volume delta V. This volume delta V shall still be a lot larger than the molecular scales, meaning each unit cell shall contain a lot of molecules, but still it shall be a lot smaller than the cubic volume given by the light wavelength, and to be precise, even smaller, namely the volume given by the cube of a 20th of the light wavelength. We can then balance concentration fluctuations in our system to occur by molecular exchange between those elementary cells, as described in equation 6.41. If we are willing to be strict here, then we have to clarify that fluctuations do not only occur to such concentration fluctuations, but also to other types of fluctuations in the system, such as fluctuations of temperature and pressure, as fully written down in a total differential type format in equation 6.42. However, those latter fluctuations affect both the solvent and the solute equally, so we may disregard those in the following. So we can go back to just regarding concentration fluctuations. We now do so by going back to the elementary Rayleigh scattering equation 6.27, in which the polarizability alpha is featured. We can now calculate it from equation 6.41, as given in equation 6.43. That is a square equation and therefore, according to the binomial formula, features three additive terms on its right-hand side. In those, only the third term actually causes the observed light scattering intensity, because the first one is the square of an average over all volume elements, and this, like in an ideal crystal, always turns out to be zero, so it doesn't contribute to interference and therefore doesn't contribute to scattering. The second term is a deviation from the mean that can either have a positive or a negative value, so its average will also be zero, leaving us only the third term to actually cause the observed scattering intensity. By inserting this last term into the Rayleigh equation 6.27, we generate equation 6.44. In that, we now have a mean square fluctuation of the polarizability alpha, which in turn is connected to the refractive index as given in equation 6.45, which in turn introduces a mean square concentration fluctuation, and that in turn can be obtained from statistical thermodynamics as denoted in equation 6.46. If we now plug that into our above formula and use a virial series expansion for the concentration-dependent osmotic pressure that is featured in the denominator of equation 6.46, we obtain the virial series expansion of equation 6.47. The first part, the first virial series term, matches the fundamental equation 6.40 we have encountered earlier, and now on top of that, we have a virial series expansion, featuring the second virial coefficient of the virial series expansion of the osmotic pressure, as we have just used this in there a minute ago. We have to furthermore refine that formula if we want to account for not only small molecules, but also large molecules, meaning macromolecules, specifically macromolecules larger than a 20th of the wavelength of the scattered radiation, which roughly corresponds to sizes of 20 nanometers or larger. In this case, we will also have intramolecular interference, which magnitude depends on the viewpoint angle, as sketched in figure 101. If we also account for this, we obtain equation 6.48, which now features the form factor of our scattering macromolecules. This form factor we know from our last lesson unit, wherein which was given to us by equation 6.17, And if we now adopt this, along with the definition of the scattering wave vector as given in equation 6.4, also in our last lesson unit, we obtain equation 6.49. And inserting that back into equation 6.48 turns it into equation 6.50. This equation appears to be quite frightening and lengthy at a first view, but in fact it's actually a very simple equation. It just contains many parameters. But the bottom line of it is that it gives us the Rayleigh ratio, which is a normalized measure of the scattering intensity, calculated together with an optical constant K and the sample concentration C, to be dependent on the weight average molar mass of our scatterers, their size as given by the radius of gyration, and their interactions to each other as given by the second virial coefficients, which are all three very fundamental important polymer physical parameters that can all be determined from a light scattering experiment, as we see when we look upon equation 6.50. Now, as this equation contains many parameters and we cannot obtain all the three interesting ones at once, we have to do an experimental series by measuring at many scattering angles theta and at many concentrations C. But if we do so and then normalize to the zero realization of one or the other, we systematically can unravel these three parameters MW, RG, and A2, which is done in a so-called ZIM plot, as sketched in figure 102. One further note at this point. In our derivation, we have introduced an insight from statistical thermodynamics, which has given us the mean square concentration fluctuation in equation 6.46. An alternative way to express this is given in equation 6.51 that features a volume element normalized Gibbs free energy, which enters here in the denominator. When we remember our elementary education in physical chemistry 1, or alternatively also, if we remember our education in the first part of this lecture series, physical chemistry of polymers 1, we may recall that there is a point where this concentration derivative of Gibbs free energy, as it's featured in equation 6.51, is nearly zero, where the concentration-dependent Gibbs free energy is a flat line. This is the case at a critical demixing point, as sketched in figure 103. At this point, therefore, this denominator in equation 6.51 turns out to be very small, and as such, the entire ratio turns out to be very large. So here, the concentration fluctuations diverge, giving us a very strong scattering intensity, referred to as critical opalescence. Such a point is encountered in a process of spinodal decomposition, as we have discussed it in the 8th lesson unit of our Physical Chemistry of Polymers 1 class. At such a critical spinodal demixing point, concentration fluctuations self-amplify and diverge, and a former homogeneous single phase separates by a microscopic process named uphill diffusion, in a sense that the molecules diffuse such to exacerbate local concentration gradients rather than what they normally do, flattening them. And thereby, phase-separated domains form and then diverge in size. This is detectable in form of a diverging scattering intensity, named critical opalescence. Alright, so far so good. With that, we have seen that static light scattering is a very powerful method in polymer science, as it allows us to conduct an experimental series that lead to a ZIM-type kind of data analysis, often done in terms of a ZIM-plot graphical representation as sketched in figure 102, thereby delivering us three elementary polymer characteristics variables, the weight average molar mass, the radius of gyration, and the second virial coefficient. Footnote here, by the way, the latter two are obtained as Z averages, as denoted in the footnote in that context in our accompanying lecture script. There is a further way to conduct scattering experiments, and this is in a time-resolved fashion, referred to as dynamic light scattering. We have said already along our way that the scattering intensity fluctuates due to thermal fluctuations. So if we record a time-dependent scattering intensity, we will obtain a fluctuating scattering intensity signal, as sketched in figure 104a. The scattering intensity fluctuates around an average value, here denoted as I in spiked parentheses. We can guess here already that the temporal course of these fluctuations is related to thermal motion, and as such, there must be some kind of way to get information on that thermal motion from those fluctuations. And this is what's done in dynamic light scattering. What we do here is we record a signal as the one shown in figure 104a, and then apply an autocorrelation analysis of this signal, the mathematical definition of which is given in equation 6.53. What we do here in words is we duplicate the signal and then shift the duplicate from the original and always compare the shifted duplicate to the remaining original and see how far they are still related to each other, so to speak. We can see from this conceptual description already that the further we shift the duplicate from the original, the less and less and less will they remain to be alike. And the mathematical quantification of this alikeness, which is named the autocorrelation amplitude, therefore drops, as sketched in figure 104 B and C, whereby B sketches this in a linear form and C sketches this in a semi-log representation. There is a somehow characteristic point in that decay, which is the point where the autocorrelation has decayed down to a fraction of 1 over e of the original. This occurs in a characteristic time tau 0 that is seen as an inflection point in the semi-log representation of figure 104c. What has happened in the sample microscopically at that time is that the scattering centers have displaced against each other by distances corresponding to 1 over q, the inverse scattering wave factor. That we can plug into an Einstein-Smoluchowski analog equation as given by number 6.54, from which we can determine the constant of proportionality in it, the translational diffusion coefficient, simply by measuring tau zero, the characteristic time in the decaying autocorrelation analysis, at different scattering wave vectors q, meaning at different scattering angles. Plotting 1 over tau zero versus q squared then should give a straight line with a slope of capital D of the translational diffusion coefficient. That parameter can then be further used by plugging it into the Stokes-Einstein equation, thereby translating it into a hydrodynamic radius, which is the radius of an either real or imaginary perfectly spherical particle that diffuses in our medium. What actually diffuses in our medium is, of course, not spherical particles, but Gaussian polymer chains. But what this light scattering analysis gives us is a measure of their hydrodynamic size, which is the size that an ideal spherical object would have that has the same diffusive properties than our coil of interest, which is, of course, some kind of reliable measure of the coil size. So with that, dynamic light scattering also gives us a structural information. It actually gives us a dynamic information, but that can be translated into a structural information. And in many experimental setups, this is actually done automatically, meaning the instrument software that operates with dynamic light scattering setups often directly displays to the user a hydrodynamic radius. What is behind this is that the setup has actually determined a translational diffusion coefficient, as denoted to us in equation 6.54, and then already inherently used the Stokes-Einstein equation to translate this into a hydrodynamic radius. What the method therefore determines is actually dynamic information, which can, however, directly translate it into structural information, given by a hydrodynamic radius. This goes hand in hand with the radius of gyration that is given to us in the static scattering analysis. And what is very interesting is the ratio of these two quantities, because that has to do with the shape, with the geometry of the object. So in conjunction, static and dynamic light scattering can give rich information about the structure of a colloidal sample under investigation, in our case, a polymeric dilute solution. And along with that, as we have seen, static light scattering furthermore gives us information on interactions, as quantified by the second virial coefficient A2, and on a weight average molar mass. With that, we see what rich insight we can get from light scattering, which is, let me say that again, a comparably simple and easy to implement, and also comparably cheap experimental methodology to acquire that information. Most ideally, this analysis is then flanked further by X-ray, or if possible, even neutron scattering, to give us even richer structural insight on multiple length scales, such that in the end, we have a profound picture on the structure of the polymeric building blocks and the entire amorphous sample they constitute, which we can then flank further in the context of our knowledge on ideal and real polymer chains, meaning on the Gaussian entropic nature of the single elementary chain and potential interactions within the chain and between the chains. And that, as we have seen, should then translate into macroscopic measurable properties. For example, mechanical properties, like the viscosity of a polymer melt that scales with the molar mass of the chains. With such connections and with such a working approach, the intended arcing bridge between the fields of polymer chemistry, that primarily targets polymer chemical structures, and polymer engineering, that primarily targets macroscopic polymer properties and function, is achieved. And from there on, rational design of new, advanced functional polymer materials that fulfill new desired functions in fields that we may not yet even imagine in our minds is possible on the very same premise and by the very same approach, allowing materials to be designed that perfectly match an intended application. This shows us again how powerful the field of physical chemistry of polymers is, as it allows for nothing less than for totally rational materials design. It's a little unfortunate that users in the end don't see all this effort. They actually don't care about it even. A user of a material is careless about the beauty of the molecules in it. Users are only interested in the function that the material provides. Once I read in the foreword of the MRS Bulletin, the Bulletin Journal of the Materials Research Society, that the ideal material is one that a user actually never realizes, as it just fulfills its function perfectly and therefore doesn't become apparent to the user, who usually starts to realize that the material is there when it fails, such that when the material does not perform as intended. As unfortunate this may be to us as materials developers, who put a lot of effort in achieving exactly that goal, it in the end comes down to a very satisfying conclusion. Materials in the world around us do not only make it more comfortable for us, but serve to provide a function that we as humans then no longer need to fulfill or need to circumvent, thereby not only making our lives more comfortable, but enriching it with freedom, freedom of time and freedom of mind. And if you, in your later profession, will be a person capable of doing this, will be a person delivering a material that provides functions which are of high interest to a large group of people out there, you and your knowledge will be worthy. That, I hope, will eventually give you the last missing piece of motivation to further engage in polymer materials research and development.